Historia Canadiana is recorded on the unceded lands of the Kanien'kehá:ka First Nation.
Greetings and salutations, friends. It's me, ya boy, Mackenzie. Back at it again for another rousing episode of Pop Canada, the show where we deep dive into the world of pop culture and discuss the role of our country within the larger pop culture landscape. Today, with me as always, is my better half, my second in command, my right-hand man, left-hand man, he's all my hands, he's my feet, it's Patrick.
Hi. Today, I love how you were going, like, you were really, like, building up. It sounded like a wrestling thing, and then it just kind of fizzled out into
Sunday! Tune in for another episode of Pop Canada! Today, we are talking about a larger theme often seen in Canadian culture and Canadian media, and that is nature. We're going green this episode, woo! And we're going to talk about the role of nature in pop culture in the landscape of Canada, how it plays into part of our natural identity, how it plays in our national identity. I'm going to do that switch a lot today.
Natural, national.
Yeah, natural, national. And just sort of examine why, how, and how important this is. Mm-hmm. For those of you who don't know, we are in the middle of COP26 and in the middle of the climate crisis.
Yep.
So this is us sort of talking about it, building off relevancy and SEO. Woohoo!
Maybe we'll get another patron out of this. Who knows?
Well, I'm thinking I might just make this episode free because I really do think this is an important topic to talk about.
We can do that.
Yay! Cool. I got permission from my overlord taskmaster. Woo-woo!
But I'm actually curious just to kind of start off this conversation. Like you mentioned something really relevant of like nature is an underlying theme in how we imagine Canada in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. right? And we'll talk about many of the ways that it's done so ostensibly forever, or at least up until, I guess, the mid-20th century. I don't know if it's still true today. We'll see. But do you feel like it's been addressed enough, like as a thing, or do you feel like people just take this for granted that Canada is seen as this haven of nature? Or
do you think it for granted? I really do think we're definitely better than other places, but the problem is people only look, so all the positives that people talk about are right, but they don't then take a look at the other side, the negatives that exist revolving around our nature and our natural landscape.
Right.
Because there are some very strong negatives there. Per capita, Canadians produce more CO2 than almost the rest of the world.
Yes. Now, as we were saying, like there's a but with that one, but yeah, per capita.
Yeah, but per capita, not worldwide. Mm-hmm. Canada amounts for 2% of CO2 emissions. But if we had if we had the population of, say, the US, the world would be dead because of Canada.
Oops.
Sorry about that, eh? We're going to talk more about the problems there, but I want us to go all the way back and trace where this came from, sort of looking at we're going to talk about your wheelhouse a bit more, the more traditional texts medias and literacies of how this came about, because I think it's really interesting. We've definitely touched on it in Historia Canadiana.
Yes, absolutely. So we'll kind of go over some of those again, at least as an overview. But there's some things that I think we'll address here that we haven't touched upon in Historia Canadiana that we might eventually.
Independence from the mother series.
You can't go too far off, though. Like, no, I'm warning.
Yes, sir.
This is your first
that's
warning.
That's really why you're here. You just don't trust me to run my own series.
I'm this big other watching over you constantly, giving you the illusion
big
of power.
Other? A big brother?
It's, never mind. I'm not going to get into it.
Big brother.
This is some Lacanian psychoanalysis.
What are you doing, stepbrother?
And we just lost that single patron that we would have gotten out of this.
Gonna have to edit that joke out.
No, absolutely not.
Fix it in post.
No, but yeah, okay. Where do you want to start with this?
So I was thinking we start because I remember in the poetry, the text, and so on that we have looked at on Historia Canadiana, the focus is always on the wonder of nature, and it's always been built that way. And I have to wonder, like, what's your opinion on how much that designated where we would go. Because I don't know so much the politics of how things sort of began, but there's always seems to me in Canadian literature this focus for us to be like, just look at our landscape, like how gorgeous this is. This is, I've never seen anything like this. And I really got to think that fostered some sort of seed within us to be like, we need to protect this.
Yeah, I think so. I think part of there are many reasons for that. I think part of that comes from the way in which, you know, the literature emerged in Canada. Mm-hmm. So obviously we can go as far back as like Indigenous populations who had like this very big and complex association with nature, who saw themselves as part of a natural landscape rather than interacting with it. We can get into a bit of that later, but in terms of purely literary output, as we understand it from like a European or Western perspective, if you will, mm-hmm. you know, like from the get-go, the very first poems that we find in what we now know as Canada, so what would have been produced in Newfoundland at the time, that's pretty much all you could talk about, right, was the landscape. So it kind of sets the bar to a certain level, because you either talk about, well, in the case of Newfoundland, for example, like the crashing waves and the difficulty of interacting with this really harsh environment.
All the fish.
Yo, for real, the fish.
Just flooding you.
Mm-hmm. And you also immediately get this rhetoric of like modern versus imagined past, right? That I think underlies a lot of how we view nature, right? Because a lot of the rhetoric, like the European rhetoric coming here was like, oh, okay, well, the old world is modern, right? That's like the Europe and all
it's
that. That's the pinnacle of civilization.
Man. It sure is pretty.
Exactly. But like for all its problems, this is like the pinnacle of civilization of modern times.
Yeah, whereas, that was part of the problem. They had too many people and there was so little space. Mm-hmm. And that plays into the other part of Canada we'll talk into. Canada has a lot of space more than anything else. We've just got like oodle caboodles of space. Everybody lives in that little southern part of Canada, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, as soon as you get here and see the swaths of like quote unquote emptiness, right? Because a lot of that perspective coming into like the 17th and 18th centuries coming mm-hmm. into colonization was like, oh, well, there's nothing here, because it was going into with the idea of if the land isn't being actively used for agriculture or being settled, then it's not there. Then it doesn't exist as we conceive it as like settler colonials. Right.
And well, I also, going back to the settlers and the colonials, as a colonized nation, we were different insofar as that we weren't set up to be a settlement, really. We were more just conceived as a series of trading posts. We came, we weren't there for, people didn't come here for plantations. They didn't come here to farm tobacco or cotton or any of those other things. They wanted the furs. And if you want to preserve the furs, there's a recognition I have to leave the environment alone so that the beavers and the other animals can keep copulating, keep producing more furs. So I think that our slow start sort of helped guarantee a more protective version for nature, because we weren't like, we need to tear everything down. We need to make room for all the fields and all the planting and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And what kind of emerges from that perspective is a kind of conservatism, right? And, you know, say what you will about like the political ideology, but I mean like a conservatism of we need to maintain this idea that we have, mm-hmm. right? And that kind of, I think, shows through all the way into the 19th century, where you were mentioning like some of the poetry that we talk about on Historia Canadiana and all that, like that idealism and right. that nostalgia for that past, for that natural past, very much still appears, but it appears within the context of an industrialized world or an industrializing world. Mm-hmm. And so the perspective is different, but the underlying idea of needing to protect nature because it's what we knew for so long and because it's what, you know, surrounds us most clearly right here in Canada.
Penetrates us.
But for real though, when you were laughing about the fact that we have very little people here, like, yeah, I know. And like we still to this very day, even if we don't necessarily acknowledge it, like you were saying, we do still have to face the reality that most of Canada is not really inhabited. Like 90% of its population lives on the border. Mm-hmm. And there have been there's been a lot of analyses from a artistic point of view as to what that does to a people, to like a mindset, right? So the most famous one that kind of comes to my mind is Northrop Frye, who right. was a literary critic who was very popular in the 50s. He comes from Sherbrooke, actually. And he had this really interesting perspective of what he called the garrison mentality, right? Which he kind of identified in a big part of Canadian literature, especially early Canadian literature. So to kind of come back to your idea of the outpost, you had this idea that you had this single point of civilization that you had to protect against all the unknown that existed out there. Mm-hmm. Right. And so according to him, you see a lot of this natural writing as a kind of unconscious way of conquering the landscape, right? Of saying, like, because we don't know what's out there, whether it's indigenous populations, which we see as quote unquote savages at the time, or for a big part of our history, or just our own fears of like other colonial powers or animals, or just the actual like terrors of nature, because a freaking snowstorm can be very dangerous, right? We kind of use literature and artistic output as a way to dominate nature in our minds and make it less scary, which I think is an
interesting. Dominating.
No, exactly. At least that's for early like perspectives on it. We can say what you will about like a post-industrial world or like an industrialized world here in North America is very much dominating in a very literal sense nature, but it wasn't necessarily as flagrant at the time, I would say. Yeah. I don't know. That's just like a very brief overview. I offered a lot of ideas here. I don't know if you wanted to
I want the brief overview of ideas because I don't want us to get bogged down right now. I just wanted us to sort of take a look back at how we became this like nature viewed country. And I do think you're right. It's a lot of the big space, the big empty vast unknown of it all, combined with the fact that we had the fur trade and we weren't relying on like conquering the land so much. We didn't conquer the land. We hid in small settlements, all that sort of stuff. And for like large swaths of Canada were originally owned by the Hudson Bay Company as well. So they didn't do anything with it because they were just setting up trading posts.
Yeah, absolutely. And to kind of like, I think that's an interesting point of saying, even when we like, when we're using the idea of conquering the land, of course, like as like we did straight up conquer in a sense, like, but
we stole the land.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. We stole that land.
But I think what you meant by that is like actually molding the land and shaping it as we understand it today
So that's more what I mean. More if we conquered the land, I mean more in the fact that we didn't rip everything up right away.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely did some of that, and we definitely disrupted the natural landscape even back then from the original First Nations people that settled there.
Yeah.
But it's more we didn't have major population centers just popping up out of nowhere, you know?
Right. Even like something like Montreal, which was for a while like the biggest or mm-hmm. like the most important city in Canada, was extremely small in compared to
Are
what
you're saying
you'd
it isn't other. Anymore?
It's one of. I don't want to insult my fellow listeners.
You don't want to insult Toronto.
But I think it is interesting.
Where the government is.
I think it is rather interesting, however, that you bring up like the Hudson's Bay Company and things like that, because it's this kind of place that or it's this kind of thing, I guess, mm-hmm. This private company that inherently wanted to control nature by its very definition, right? Like you were saying, through the fur trade or through the selling of land for the railroad and things like that, mm-hmm. or for settlement purposes. The whole idea, however, is it's kind of interesting because you see this duality with something like Rupert's Land or what the Hudson's Bay Company owned, is that it simultaneously had a plot of land or a massive plot of land where it had to exploit it by its very nature, right? By its very like goal as a company. Mm-hmm. But it simultaneously had to preserve that idea of a natural setting in a sense, because that's what it was exploiting. So it was kind of like this duality that exists in...
That still exists in many ways. Yeah, like we're still exploiting the land, but to exploit mm-hmm. it, we have to preserve it.
Yes, exactly.
And we'll touch on that a bit more as we get into like really examining the truth of many claims of Canada as the nature country.
Right, absolutely.
Do you want to give some quick examples of what people can use, what kind of poems and read, like books, paintings they can look at to see this in action?
Yeah, I mean...
Besides just studying the history of the Hudson's Bay Company, which would put anybody to sleep.
Oh, really? there are... Honestly, if you look at most of our Historia Canadiana like catalog, you'll see examples of that. If you look at like early Newfoundland poetry, you'll see that. What's his name? Who wrote Quadlibets? who was one of, he was basically the first poetry in Newfoundland ever. And I'm blanking on the name right now, but I'm doing a quick Google search. Mm-hmm. But while I do that, there's also like some really interesting ones.
Take a look at First Nations literature.
Yes, first of all, yes.
While you Google that, I can just say that right out of the gate. Something like the novel, a more recent novel is Birdie, but also take a look at First Nations myth and folklore, the culture there. Study, like, you take a look at that to sort of understand the original concept of nature as seen through the First Nations lens, because they have such a rich and beautiful way of looking things that way.
Yeah. And I found him.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I found it. Robert Heyman's Quodlibets, which was published in 1628. It's not super imaginative, but it does give an idea of what that kind of mentality was being looked at, or like how that was being examined. If not, I think a really interesting example as well is what's it called? John Richardson's Wacusta, which came out in 1820s, I think, something around there, and talks about a time during Pontiac's Rebellion, so the 1760s. So it's set in the 1760s, but written 100 years later about. And it's really interesting because it very much demonstrates in a very specific way that garrison mentality that we were talking about with Fry, Northrop Fry, because it's all about this colonial, this British person, right, who has like a love triangle and things like that, as typical Victorian novels do. But at the same time, he's faced with this danger that's coming from the forest, and this unknown danger, this savage danger that's haunting him at all times. And you come to find out like what that danger is, and it's like an old it's the person who his wife previously loved, basically, who's coming back for revenge. And so it works on many levels of like what the nature does to you, and the quote unquote idea of going native that a lot of Europeans ascribed to settler colonials. And so it's really interesting. It works on many levels. It's a bit of a long one to read, but it is really interesting and kind of stands out, I think, as one of the main literary highlights of that time. And also, you can also look at a later set of poets, which we'll talk about eventually on Historia Canadiana, called the Confederation poets. Right? We've talked about them before, so like Duncan Scott, Archibald Lampman, that group that wrote much later in the 19th century, and very much embody that sentiment that I'm bringing up of reacting to industrialization. Right. And imagining nature in a much more romantic way because of it. Right. Okay. So yeah, those are all like paths that we can follow on that end. Also, folk tales is a good segue.
Just in general, yeah, keep looking at folk tales. Those are always fun things to look at. But if this all sounds like you don't want folk tales and you want some more modern stuff, this is a topic and idea that has continued to today. Our TV shows, our movies, our programs are still very nature centered.
Do you find, like, as I don't watch that much TV in general now, so I would rely more on you for that. Yeah.
It's hard to find like original Canadian content that's more, but even in like, okay, so despite my problems with Margaret Atwood, Handmaid's Tale seems, from what I understand, still has Canada there as this, again, playing it as the new unknown, unexplored land that's free from the tyranny of men.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that's, again, it's not a direct link to nature, but it's still playing with those same themes that's always been in Canada. As a kid growing up, I watched the cartoon Iggy Arbuckle, which was about a park ranger.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, he works in a large national park, and it's like, the Canadian animated series, Iggy Arbuckle. The Jimmy Tutu? I remember there was a bunch of
Jacob
cartoons.
Jacob Tutu. There you go. Yeah.
And
do you know who actually wrote that originally?
It's Mordecai Richler.
Yeah. I didn't know that until recently. I was like, oh shit, I didn't know he wrote children's books.
Yeah, no, like it's mostly in our children's literature and cartoons that you see it, because we have a lot of those. Mm-hmm.
Of course.
We're very good at that. Just look at Caillou. But I think it is a good place to focus though on the children of the world to sort of show them like why nature is important. I remember there was another cartoon. The name escapes me right now, but it was like, it was about the North and it took place in the Northern tundra or something. It was like this whole ice fishing thing.
Okay.
Anyway. Interesting. Yeah. It's always sort of a pivotal part is our natural beauty and wonder. And to sort of play, to keep building on that, more obvious example is advertising.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I don't know about you, but anytime I see advertising for Newfoundland, New Brunswick, BC, Quebec, Ontario, it's always the sweeping shots of the forts. It's always like, come to Canada.
Yes.
Enjoy the nature. Enjoy the land. This land that exists just for you. And it's like waves crashing. People are chilling around fires, like having a good time, sipping martinis.
Yep. Or even when you see an ad for things like a city, for example, like to come back to whichever, honestly, you always see
Quebec City.
Sure. You always see a shot of the water as well.
Yeah.
Like kind of coming in and seeing this relate. I don't know how intentional it is. Probably it is, but it's the idea of like relating back the modern and the old, right? And this idea of, again, opening up to the potentials of nature.
We always have that fusion of old and new in Canada. When in our advertising, especially, we always talk about, you know, Canada's always seen as this, a place of traditional values mixed with more modern values. Sort of meeting in a halfway point. That's part of the nature, again. It's part of this big fusion of it. Yeah. So it's a really fascinating thing to be like, that is our advertising. That Absolutely. Is how ingrained nature has become within the Canadian mind and the mind of outsiders viewing Canada.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you honestly wanted to study the imagery of nature in Canada in a more modern setting, look up the commercials. Look up the New Brunswick commercials, the Quebec commercials, all those fun things, because this is what they'll talk about.
Yeah.
And even more specifically, look at the Parks Canada.
Yeah.
Study anything Parks Canada, basically, because that is, it's such a large part of, I've worked in the park system before, and like it's such a big draw for our tourism industry. Like all the parks, we have so many of them. It's like there's a couple hundred research and conservation sites, and there's something like 60 parks.
Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, I think it might be even more than that. I'm not sure. Or I'm thinking of national historic sites, maybe.
Yeah, no, the national historic sites easily climbs into the hundreds.
But it is kind of interesting, though, to think about the fact that a lot of national historic sites are managed by Parks Canada, though.
Okay, so there's 48 national parks in Canada.
Okay, cool.
But so you can look this up, and it's a really like interesting thing to read on the Government of Canada website, how much they talk about it, how much more updated it looks compared to everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And just it's kind of fascinating. I really like it. Like, I do love that part about Canada that really puts into perspective just how much we care about it, and or how much we appear to care about it, as we'll be talking about later. And I always find it's a fascinating thing to study advertising as well, and understanding how Canada has continued to build up this image as the nature place.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking about this now because I put down on the notes earlier, right, mid-20th century novels, or like early 20th century novels, like those from the 1920s, 30s, just before the Great Depression kind of thing.
Okay. It's
interesting because that's when you really saw an uptick, for example, of Western immigration, right, in Canada. So like, it was increasing throughout the 19th century, but it really like hit its peak during this time. And it's really interesting, speaking of ads, to look at the way that immigrants were encouraged to come to places like Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, and the kind of rhetoric that was being used in those posters that intrinsically related people to nature, right? So, for example, I remember some of the ads, and this was seen when I was visiting Grosse-Île, which is actually near Quebec City, and one of the ads was really interesting because it was focusing on the fact that you should come to Canada because of the cold, for example, because apparently it's healthier for you. Or that was what the ad was saying, right? So there's this...
Yeah, well, there's the cold. I think it is better for you. It's like it's a bit healthier, the cold.
I don't know. Like, I really don't know.
There's health benefits to it.
Okay.
It's obviously don't have all the cold all the time, but there's benefits.
Right. But that was like, I did think that was an interesting point to make, or like something that I'd never thought of, or like the way that it's used and deployed as an argument for coming here is like, no, you'll actually grow into a stronger person and a healthier person if you're faced with the cold, right? Now,
the cold.
I know there was a whole examination of like imperial rhetoric about that, of how like people from the north were better because they knew how to face the cold. So you saw a lot of that as well.
The plane.
Oh yeah. But it is really interesting. And by the way, as another kind of recommendation for books and stuff like that from this time, and this might be just me because that's what I'm hoping to study for my PhD, but there's a lot of novels from this time that are really interesting in how they describe characters as having very specific natural characteristics. So the one I most recently finished was called Wild Geese by Martha Ostenso, which was written in 1925, I think, and kind of depicts this prairie settlement in a really interesting way, because the main patriarch of that specific Manitoba farm, for example, Caleb Gare, is always described as having like a very visceral and direct connection with the land, right? And how that affects his mentality in rather specific ways, I think, is very much worthy of note. Mm-hmm. So he's described often with very geological qualities, like he's a rock of a man, for example. So it kind of relates him very specifically to the earth. And I see, at least I remember seeing a lot of that kind of imagery popping up in novels at that time, just as a lot of people were coming in to immigrate and settle in Western Canada, which I think is worthy of note just in general. I find that interesting. Like the construction of a person itself as being natural, and very nature-centered in Canada, right? I don't know if you saw similar things in the U.S. With the Western drives, but I have no idea, but I did the... Sorry, I spoke a lot. Like, I don't know if you see like similar types of rhetoric in the U.S., for example, of associating people with nature as they were moving west like you did in Canada, but...
There was always... From what I can understand, yeah, the Wild West Tales was there and there was the focus, but it was always, the talk was always about, we are settling this now. Mm-hmm. We are making towns. This is a frontier that we are conquering to turn into another place.
Right.
And I never got that as much with Canadian literature.
Okay.
There was never a tie. Like the focus was, obviously we still conquered. We still did that. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't like, we didn't talk about it in the same way. We didn't have the same language.
Right.
If that makes sense.
That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah, was there anything else you wanted to bring up in terms of like older forms or just like general pop culture? Because we can talk about like paintings or like iconography and things like that.
I think we'll have a list. I'll work with you. We'll compile a list and we'll have a link for that with the episode when it drops, just so that way people can be like, I want to give a list of resources so people can really see this one.
Definitely. Yeah, sure.
It's a good thing to study.
Yeah, just in terms of... I don't think I'll talk about coins just because it's a pretty obvious one, but it does kind of demonstrate it.
Our coins are always filled with nature, iconography, and symbols.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even look like clothing brands and stores, you know, Roots has always focused itself around the beaver, the green, the nature, and the hiking. Mm-hmm. Arc'teryx, major brand within Canada. I don't know if it's Canadian. I don't think it's Canadian brand itself.
I don't know.
But it has a major presence here. It's always these types of things that we see, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. Does it say it? Drum roll. Yeah, it's located in North Vancouver.
There you go. And these are the things that this, what our country does.
Yeah.
Our branding is tied to nature as part of this national identity, our national natural identity.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting, right? Because again, like just to make like the easy comparison with the States, for example, like if you look at their own money, a lot of it is based on people.
Yeah. The founding fathers.
Yeah. Which is not something that you see as much here.
Or buildings.
Yeah.
Our money's colorful.
It smells like maple syrup.
Small part of the National Maple Reserve, which is an actual thing.
Do you find it really smells like? You mean the National Reserve? Okay. Sorry, yeah, maple syrup. Yeah. Yes.
Sorry, the Strategic Reserve. It was featuring the Great Canadian Maple Syrup Heist.
We should talk about that one day, by the way.
Oh, we will.
Oh, great.
We're going to talk about how somebody stole, what was it, 20,000 gallons?
Something like that. Insane. Absolutely insane.
But yeah, anyway, back to Nate.
Yeah, the one I wanted to mention also, and again, they deserve a whole episode in and of themselves. They're very interesting. But you can definitely see it in other things like The Group of Seven, which you can do a quick Google search and you'll see a million of their paintings pop up. But they're very much nature-centered, and you saw things like that with Riappel, for example, as well, right around this that same time. But there's always something a bit off about their depictions of nature. It's never quite realistic, right? And I think that's also something to think about, is at least within the pop cultural sphere, right? Or just cultural sphere in general, we don't always make realistic depictions of nature. There's always something that's a bit disconnected in a lot of how we imagine it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't know how much of the Group of Seven's intention was doing that, with like creating a slightly disconnected like association with nature, because it's never quite realistic. But I do think that's something that should be explored more. And eventually, when we do talk about it in full, that will probably come up, right? So yeah, that was just all the things that I had to mention in terms of like general overview. But
nice. Yeah. As I said before, I'm going to try to compile a list of more just resources. It's going to be a very simple Word document that you'll be able to download. Mm-hmm. Just sort of giving the names, the author, and a link where you can maybe find it or find more information on it.
Absolutely. Where do you want to go from here?
So now I want to talk about the other side of the coin. And I want to ask the question if Canada really is the green place that we think it is.
Okay.
Because it's, as we stated earlier, massive per capita CO2 production, and still the fact that the resources and the land were stolen.
Yes.
We're the fourth biggest producer of oil in the world.
Yeah, it's insane, right?
Yeah, and so it's because we always talk about this on Historic Canada, the sort of hidden darkness of Canada, what's lurking just beneath the surface of our pretty mm-hmm. little country. So I wanted to talk about if you think this sort of... how this affects the view of Canada. Can we really call ourselves the green country?
I think...
like, what's your... this is a general question to start us off.
Yeah. No. I think
we're not the green.
I think I'll give a general answer. I think I'll ultimately fall on the side of no. I think there are some definitely good things that are happening, but I think it's mostly contained to our own little sphere, right? And mm-hmm. what we're trying to do. And most of our ability to change environmentally here has to do with the fact that we still, you know, kind of remove resources and oil and mine other countries.
I don't want to alienate any of our listeners, mm-hmm. but that's the big strike against Canada.
Yep.
Is the tar sands.
Mm-hmm.
The Alberta oil and tar sands, the oil companies out west. That seems to be the biggest hit. And I think if we can work on that, make that carbon neutral, we can start to call ourselves more the green country. If we up the reforestation, up the preservation of the waters of places like Newfoundland, New Brunswick, up the Fish Conservation Acts, and take down more and more our reliance on oils and fossil fuels, we'll become more and more the place that is the green country.
For sure.
And I think we're almost there. Like, no country is the green country, but I think like the steps for Canada to become the green country is super easy.
It's
like the path is there. The path
it's
is
there. There. Yeah. Again, you'd kind of have to, again,
I'm not saying it would be easy, but I'm like, it wouldn't take us long to figure out how.
No. Well, we know exactly how, but
yeah, we've always known how.
But yeah, again, so like, again, that's within our own borders, but like how we have to think also of like, for example, mines in Africa or things like that, that, you know, Canadian companies are very much a part of, running and stuff like that, which, and again, in a way that doesn't necessarily have the same rules and regulations that we have here in order mm-hmm. to, limit the kind of destruction to nature that we're seeing obviously within the climate crisis. So I do think there's certainly some work to be done on the international scale as well in that regard.
For sure. And also, we are our fourth largest producer. So if we stop mm-hmm. selling, that can have a big impact on the rest. If we stop selling the commodities of oil and such and start exporting different things, like, yeah, our economy will take a hit in the yeah. short term. Long-term effects, though, will probably be for the benefit of Canada.
Yes. I would agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, and I want to take a look at, because a different thing I thought about was province to province.
Okay.
For example, here in Quebec, all our power is through hydro.
Mm-hmm.
We have a huge surplus of hydropower throughout the province, and so much so that we sell some of it off to the States.
Yeah.
And so, and then again, looking at Alberta and the tar sands, so do you think there is a difference in green between provinces? Are certain provinces 100% greener than others? Do they cancel that in certain ways?
Yeah, I think it's kind of inevitable that there would be some disparities in a sense. That's not to say like that we're perfect here in Quebec either, just because of our hydro.
No, obviously not.
Yeah. So, but I do think there are some changes that are going to be happening soon in places like Alberta and the West, just because I feel like a lot of people are starting to wake up to the fact that
it's not sustainable.
It's not sustainable. Exactly. Whether you have it as a part of your economy, that's fine, but you have to transition towards something else just because the nature of oil, right?
Yeah,
it's a limited resource.
It is a limited. We only have so much of it, and more to the fact, it's just the mindset is finally starting to change here, thankfully.
Yeah.
And again, I think that's part of why Canada is on the track to become a green country, just because our mindset is so different. Because my family recently met with some of their old friends from the States. And my mother was talking about how there's composting, there's a lot more green cars. We're getting the green car production is up in Canada in a big way. And they were all the American friends were just sort of sitting there just like, we have none of that. We have nobody's even talking about that.
Right. It's extremely limited. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think it's kind of interesting in that way that comparatively, again, it's like we've always said, try not to compare to other countries, because if you're getting a 3 out of 10 and somebody else is getting a 1 out of 10, you're all still failing. That's the analogy.
Yeah, right?
We're doing better than other countries, but we have a 3 out of 10 compared to their 1 out of 10.
Yeah. It's
but the mindset is on a quicker track to change. And I really do think the surface level stuff that we've always, that's been the illusion, is becoming the reality.
Mm-hmm.
Our illusion is starting to become reality, which is kind of hopeful.
Yeah, in a sense, right? But it's also, I do feel like we need to mention this one. I don't know how much you've been following what's happening in BC, right, with Fairy Creek.
Ooh, it's this. Talk to me.
So it's been going on for a few months now. I think that'll be part of some of the links that we post for this particular show is a bit of coverage on that. But you know, at least for me, we kind of had this idea of British Columbia as a bit more as not really as oil centered as or as like destructive centered as like other Western provinces.
Locations.
Right. But it's been recently happening that a big deforestation plan in Fairy Creek has been the subject of a lot of actual protests and things like that. And it's considered one of the largest civil protests in Canadian history, actually.
Well, because that's going to get real interesting with what the pledge at COP26 that just happened, no more deforestation.
Mm-hmm.
That was the big pledge. So
yeah,
it'll be interesting to see if Trudeau can keep to it.
We'll see, because
and he steps in and he says no.
I mean, hopefully
if he sends Stephen G. Poole. He sends our green Jesus out.
But it is kind of interesting. Like the thing in Fairy Creek is doubly interesting because for a while they were stopping reporters from getting in. So there was a whole thing of like a lot of the people who are protesting are Indigenous, by the way, not exclusively, but a lot of them are.
Yeah.
And there was this whole thing with the police intervening, and obviously there was a whole thing on police brutality, and that was perhaps one of the reasons why reporters were not allowed to get in. And so information has kind of been slowly trickling out from that whole thing, but it's been quite an interesting microcosm of what's happening in terms of the environment here in Canada and in BC of like, how are we talking about the protests, right? How are we talking about the people who are actually on the ground and saying like, no, enough is enough. I think there's a double-edged sword to this. Like, yeah, I think things are definitely changing, but you still see examples of things like Fairy Creek where you're like, what's going on there? You know?
Yeah. Well, it's the fact that we're finally starting to get more coverage of it too.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
and you can thank a lot of independent news outlets for that one, by the way.
And that just goes to show it's a very slow change that needs to be a lot faster, but change is coming.
Mm-hmm.
People are finally like waking up and be like, whoa, 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 whoa. We're kind of in the shitter right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess a question for you, and this can kind of like segue us into like why into the importance of this, I guess. Mm-hmm. But like, if, for example, within the next month, right, everything that we've been talking about comes true in terms of here, right? So again, the number two or one of the highest producers per capita of greenhouse gas, like you were saying, right? It's like changes and we get better. Do you think that it will be enough to kind of start a more generalized movement? Because I think we are on the way, but I don't know if it'll be enough.
I think it's we aren't hopeless, and I think we can all be cautiously optimistic, but we can never be complacent. That's the problem. If we get complacent, then we will lose. But as long as we can keep momentum building, keep it going, and keep the mindset, like, be aware, just think about what you do, and like, do you need to leave the lights on in the middle of the day? Do you though?
No, absolutely not.
And it's like, these are the thoughts you need to start having. And that will generate a more large and more general mind change. Do you need to eat red meat every day? No. You don't need to eat beef, dairy, all these other things. Like, try having a more plant-based diet, maybe. Try doing this. Like, there's a thousand small things that when added together become one very large thing.
That's true.
And I think that's the best way to get people to change, is to make it so it's not so scary to them. Because a lot of people have this idea of climate change. Like, I have to give up everything. I have to live on a farm now. It's like, no.
I mean, that wouldn't be so bad. That'd be kind of cool.
No, but sweetie, no. Like, you don't have to do that much. No. You can deep breath. Like, you make proper changes. You don't drive the car so much. You walk, take public transit, like all that sort of stuff. We are seeing a major uptick in green cars in Canada.
That's true.
And it's just growing more and more. GM has pledged to put 100,000 charging stands throughout the country. Mm-hmm. Every time I go out and I'm walking around, I see more and more large vehicles like buses, trucks, and all that have the green symbol on them,
yeah,
saying that they're fully electric.
Absolutely.
I don't know if we'll be able to do it in time, but I think Canada is in a good place to become climate resilient. Mm-hmm. And I think the people here are waking up enough to get on board so that we can prevent a lot of the most dangerous damage.
Okay.
And we can come out of this just a little, like, not good, but not the end times.
Right. We're not seeing the apocalypse yet.
No, and I think that's a big misconception people have with climate change. Mm-hmm. Is when you think about it, it's going to be Mad Max is what we're going to turn it into. And it's like, not really, folks. We're not all going to be wearing leather and screaming fucking for, what was the thing?
I don't remember, but
all those quotes we had. But no, that's not what we're going to be doing.
it's a leather apocalypse.
Yeah. the more likely outcome is things are just going to be pretty shit.
Yeah.
And it's just going to be pretty shit for the really poor parts of the population.
Yes, always.
So if you're a listener to us, you probably won't be affected as harshly by the climate crisis. It won't hit you as hard. It won't hit us as hard. We'll feel the effects, definitely. But it's like, it's more about saving the other people of the world.
Yeah. And that's the thing, right? It's like, I don't really, for me, that's not a sufficient argument of saying like, oh, it's not going to hit us as hard. I get what you're going for, and I'm kind of extrapolating here, but I get what you're going for.
No, go ahead, do it.
To me,
I'm trying to raise awareness of the fact that we still need to do it. Like, honestly, you don't need to do the major, huge lifestyle changes. And honestly, you probably won't see as many of the effects, but that shouldn't mean you shouldn't make those changes.
Exactly. Just because you won't doesn't mean you shouldn't, and it doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to build a better future for your children or your grandchildren or things like that, right? I think part of the reason why we're in this crisis is because we have not been thinking on a large enough scale, right? We think about like, oh, okay, well, I have my, and that's good, like you're saying, I have like my own little garden and I'm trying to live a greener life in which I eat a little bit less red meat and things like that. And all of that is great. Mm-hmm. But we need to, and I think that's where the importance of conferences like COP26.
Which is going on right now, other great resource to look at.
Right, which is kind of important to think about, is like, how do we change this, but on like a system-wide scale of like our methods of production, right? Or do we overproduce, or how do we think of our relation to one another, right? Do we
need... Oh, no, for sure. And it's we can't ask for people to make super big lifestyle changes and then maintain that. That's not sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that with the COVID-19 vaccination.
Right.
You could get people to quarantine and sit in the lockdown for only a certain amount of time before people were done with it.
Yes.
So I do think these major, like the major changes in production do need to happen, but it's going to happen over a different timetable.
Yes.
And it's absolutely not going to be, it's not going to, we can't make, we need to make radical changes,
mm-hmm.
but we have to be aware of the threshold of what the population of people can reject or accept.
Yeah. As in terms of going off of that, I know I've mentioned that book to you, but it hasn't been recorded. Like it wasn't part of the recording. I'm reading this book as part of my school, as part of my PhD research. And I think it's very interesting. And if people are interested in a bit more of an academic outlook on this, it's definitely worth a look. And you can probably find it relatively free or completely free if you know how to surf the web long enough.
What's the name of the book?
So the book is called The Climate of History in a Planetary Age by Dipesh Chakrabarty, which came out in 2021. It came out this year, I think earlier in February. And it's really interesting because it basically it advances the idea that we need to reconsider the very way in which we conceive of humans as historical agents,
mm-hmm.
right? As independent historical agents, right? And we tend to, at least in this day and age, kind of focus the blame, for example, of the climate crisis on, say, capitalism, right? Of our overproduction. But what he kind of indicates in a really interesting way is that that's a very limited view of things, right? Because humans, as far as we've existed, have always had some kind of impact on the world. It may not have been a solely destructive one, but we've always had some kind of relation to the world. And he's kind of advancing this idea of like, we need to think on a wider scope, not just in terms of how we live, but in how we think of time itself as going beyond the merely human, right? And I think it's really interesting. It gets a bit heady at times, but if people are up for the task of reading it, honestly, I recommend it. I think it's a really good summation of that.
And I also want to give this disclaimer. When we give these lists of resources, don't do it all at once. You will overwhelm yourself.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
You will be paralyzed in a panic.
Absolutely. Yeah. So no, that's a definite good point there.
And so like, take your time, examine what's good for you, still find a way to live with these changes and live with the where we are.
Yeah, absolutely.
The resources provided, you do not have to look at all of them.
Look at any of them. Whatever the hell you want.
You can also just choose to be like, you know what? I'm just going to make small changes that these guys mentioned.
Yep.
I'm just going to not buy a new shirt every day.
Yeah.
Because that's a fast fashion is a major problem.
Oh, fashion. Oh, how I hate you.
It's the secret killer, the fashion industry.
Oh my God. A lot of things are secret killers when we think about it.
I'm a smooth criminal, a secret killer.
Is there anything else that you wanted to bring up?
COP26 is happening, people.
Yes.
And you know what? This is my call to Canadians. As we're in the middle of the climate crisis, let's live up to the image of what people think of us.
Mm-hmm.
If this is the image that they have, let's live up to it. Let's rise to expectations and to the occasion.
Okay. And like, make sure, like, reach out to your local politicians and like, hold them to the tasks that this thing is doing.
Give them the business.
Yeah. I know that people have this very like general sense that they have very little control over the political scene, but I think that kind of leads to nihilism in a very big bad way.
Nihilism where they don't reconstruct meaning. They just get to the point of like life is meaningless without going, okay, but now you have to construct your own meaning. That's what nihilism actually does, folks.
Yeah.
It's because about realizing there is no meaning and then creating a meaning.
Exactly. So like, I do think that there is something to say about your ability as a person to enable change and to force change, right? Or to accelerate change. And I think history, to bring it back to the general idea of our shows, has proven that time and again, right? I think we just need to kind of organize, which is easier said than done, to actually make sure that people respect these choices that are happening at COP26. Yeah. Right? Right. But yeah, well, I don't know how to do it per se. Like, organization, again, is a very difficult thing to do, but I think it is something that has a lot of potential. Yeah.
Humanity has amazing potential for change. Mm-hmm. We have an incredible history for that. We have a great track record for making the changes that need to be made when it's needed. It's just about waking up and realizing it, people. It's about accepting the fact that climate change exists.
Yeah.
And you know what? The more changes that you make now, the small ones, the less of the big changes you have to make down the line.
Absolutely.
Just as a final thought. So
yeah,
the list of resources will be provided. Other than that, go out there, take a walk, go listen to our sister series, Historia Canadiana, and listen to all the things that we just talked about in more depth and detail.
Yeah. And yeah, as always, because as you mentioned, Mackenzie, if we're probably going to release this one for free just because it's an important one. And, you know, if you like what you hear here, consider subscribing to our Patreon. You get more episodes like this, and they're all equally as fun or interesting, I think.
The rest of them are a bit lighter in topic and conversation. We talk less about the end of the world and more about... really dumb stuff like Total Drama Island, Cirque du Soleil, Michael Bublé, who is now
regular pop
out of
stuff.
His cave.
There's a podcast I listened to called The Regrettable Century.
Let's save for that one for the after. How can they support the show, Patrick, besides just supporting Patreon and listening?
They can always leave a review, right? Leave a review on iTunes. Tell your friends about it. Support us on PayPal.
We're just a couple of white guys, so please tell us when we're doing something wrong.
As always. Yeah, absolutely. Just tell us if you want to hear a specific topic, either on our main show or on Bob Canada, we'll always be happy to think about it.
And talk about it, address it, be the change we want to see in the world.
Sometimes. All right.
We have affiliate links over on Spotify that you can use where if you buy books through there, we get a bit of kickback.
Yep.
We have the Patreon. We have, what else do we have?
I think that's pretty much it. We have your love. Thank you, listener, for all of that.
So finally, final thought, in the immortal words of my great role model, Captain Planet, the power is yours. Thanks for listening. Cheers.
Yep. Bye, everyone.